Yeah, Fox, you two who are waiting outside for after the introductions. We're still going to grab you anyhow. Who are you?
I'm Rich. I'm an alcoholic.
Where are you from, Rich?
I'm from Sacramento and Fremont.
Good. How about the lady with you? That ain't saying much. You would have been better off saying you were an addict. Napa County Health Department has a rule that anybody here that's got the secondary stage of syphilis, keep your hat on so we'll know. Thank you. Give Bonnie a hand. She's got a busy social schedule. She can't get it on time. Many times on Wednesday mornings when you ask the questions that you submit that we try on Tuesday morning, you make a comment or a request that we discuss the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous on a more frequent basis while you're here. Some of you want us to discuss step 10, 11, and 12, and things like that. And I'll tell you why we hesitate to do that. First off, you're only here, most of you are only here 28 days or less. And in 28 days, that surely is not enough time for you to go through these steps deep enough that you would understand them. Hell, we could put on a fake deal and run through them on a daily basis if we wanted to and devote about 5 minutes to each one and say, yeah, well, we went through the steps while we're up there, but that wouldn't be doing you any good at all. That wouldn't be doing you any good at all. As a matter of fact, if I had my way, and we do this in the wintertime, when the schedule is a little bit more compact because of inavailability of outside activities, I think the steps that you should concentrate while you're here should really go no further than the third step of this program. There are times, of course, when some of you have been around AA for a while, go out and drink again and have a slip. Then perhaps, with you on an individual basis, we could talk a little bit further about the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, maybe 10th, 11th, and 12th steps. But I think everybody, during their stay here, should get fully acquainted with the first three steps of this program. I'm not saying that they're any more important than any other part of the program. But obviously, they put them in order, and they called them 1, 2, and 3. So they wanted to bring them to your attention pretty damn quick. And so today I'm going to talk about just steps 1, 2, and 3 as I see them and as I work them and try to disclose to you the simplicity of these steps, that they aren't really a very complicated thing. Many people try to complicate their recovery by saying, oh, I can't take all of them steps. My God, there's too much there. And, you know, you're just selling yourself short. Because I've often made a sort of a joke out of it, but a true joke. Many of us have taken almost half of these steps before you ever even attend your first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's take steps 1, 2, and 3, for example. 1, of course, is you admitted that you're an alcoholic and you're powerless over alcohol. The second one is you became willing to turn your, began to ask to be restored to sanity. And then the third one is, you know, you turn your life and your will over to the care of God as you understand it, to a power greater than yourself. Let me tell you when you took those three steps. You took them often. You took them often. You took them in jail. You took them in penitentiaries. You took them in the bathroom. You took them in your bedroom. You took them wherever the hell you were so sick you thought you were going to die. Because I believe every one of us in this room who identifies as an alcoholic or an addict, at one time or other in your recent drinking or using career, there has been moments when you've grasped your head, you know, and you're right there in the bathroom and you got that big love affair going on with the commode, you know, and you got your head down there trying to cool off that hot temple and you see the magic words, you know, American Standard, you know. I saw them so much I used to think it was my name, you know, American Standard. And you know, while you're going through that almost death, you know, you're trying to throw up and you can't throw up and you're sweating, but yet you're freezing and God, you're shaking and trembling in every nerve and every muscle in your body. Seems like it's going to jump right out of your skin, and you're scared to let loose because you don't know where it's going to come out or how it's going to come out. And here's usually what you're either vocalizing or you're thinking. You're saying things like this. Jesus Christ, I can't get off of this son of a bitch. It's driving me out of my goddamn mind. I'm going crazy. For Christ's sake, I'll do anything to get over this. For Christ's sake, God help me. That is step 1, 2, and 3 of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the admittance. That's the willingness to turn your life and will over to the care of a power greater than yourself. And your own admission that you're going crazy. Jesus Christ, I can't get off of this son of a bitch. It's driving me out of my mind. Now, I'm pretty sure all of us in this room have been in that situation at one time or another. And then the fourth step of this program, that inventory step, where we take a look at our lives. That's what brought all of you here. You see, I believe that recently in your life situation, either you or some other people who are responsible for charge of you at this time may have sat down with you and took a look at your life situation. Of exactly what's going on in your life. And your attendance here today tells me that you made a decision. You made a decision that you didn't like what was going on in your life. And at least you've become willing to investigate the possibility of maybe doing something about it. That's the fourth step of this program. The fifth step, where you admit to yourself, to God, and to one other person. Christ, you've been telling every bartender in Northern California your story for years. Everybody's been listening to your bullshit, so there's nothing new about telling about your experiences. If there's anything new in AA, it's now you're going to tell the truth. Now you're going to tell the truth. So these steps really are nothing to put up as an obstacle to your sobriety. But they apparently are the way to recover, because the men and women who wrote this book, you know, 53 years tomorrow, that's how old AA is going to be, 53 tomorrow. And 51 years ago, because they wrote the book 2 years after they had been sober, they put it down in this book what they did. They didn't say, here's what you got to do. They said, here is what we did. And then it's entirely up to you as an individual of what the hell do you want to do with the knowledge that these men and women are passing on to you. They could give a damn whether or not you stay sober. It's your problem, not theirs. Thank God for a little bit of compassion, a little bit of wisdom on their part. They said, well, why don't we put what the hell we've done down into writing in case somebody else wants to try it later on in life. And it might be easier if they learn from what we have been through. That's all the hell they did. And so they outlined these steps. And here is exactly what they said. Now, we assume that you come here wanting sobriety. And you come to Alcoholics Anonymous saying, Jesus Christ, I want to get off of this son of a bitch. What do I do? And then it's as though these 100 men and women all stand up together and say, here is what we did. If you want what we have, and they're talking only about their sobriety, they say, here are the steps that we took. They don't say, here's what you got to do. They say, here is what we did. And then that pushes it right back into your lap. Decision time. Do you or don't you? Now, if you want it, then it says, take these steps. Take these steps. And the first one, of course, is the toughest one of all, I believe. The admission to ourselves that we're alcoholic. That's exactly what it says. We admit it. We were powerless over alcohol, and that our lives had become unmanageable. The second part of that question I had a little difficulty with. You know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had never been in jail. I had never been hospitalized for booze. I wasn't being threatened with a divorce or a loss of job. Life apparently was going on as good as it could at that particular time, but with no big catastrophe over it. I had 3 sons. I was raising them, feeding them. And then you make a suggestion that my life's unmanageable. And I sort of resented that. because I didn't think it was all that unmanageable. But now as I look back in retrospect, I see where areas of it certainly were unmanageable. I looked around at people at the same station in life as me, who apparently were doing a lot better than me, had better homes, had better cars, didn't have the huge burden of debt that I seem to have, seemed to be advancing in their lives instead of being stagnant as I was. So maybe my life was unmanageable. And if you're sitting there thinking that your life isn't unmanageable, the cruelest thing I can say to you during your stay here is what I'm about to say to you. Cruelest thing I can say. And I say it out of love. And I say it because our program says that we must smash the self-centeredness. You have to smash that egotistical attitude that all alcoholics have. That denial. Only you people in here know exactly where you are in life right now. You're the only ones that know the total truth. You're the only ones that know the only truth. Because you yourself know exactly what your life situation is. Economically, relationship-wise, marriage-wise, health-wise, career-wise. Only you really know the truth. The stuff that we pass around out on the front porch and up by the swimming pool, you know, that's 99% bullshit. We all know that. All trying to impress each other. But you know the truth. And where you are right now in life is a direct result of your best effort. Think about that for a minute. Where you are in life right now is a result of your best effort. And cruelly, I'm going to remind you where you are in case you have forgotten. Especially those of you who are residents of this facility. Not that I don't think that it's good that you're here, because obviously you're willing to participate in some kind of reconstruction. But let's look at where you really are right now in life. I am a fat, bald-headed, uneducated, blood-selling wino. That's exactly what I am. And yet I'm going to tell all of you people in this room who are guests of this facility what time to go to bed tonight. What time you can get up. I'm going to tell you what time to eat, and I'm going to tell you what you have to eat. I'm going to run your life. How about that? That's where you have gotten you. You've got a jackass like me as your warden. Now, if you have any degree of humility at all, any common sense, any decency or character left inside of you, it should be easy for you to say to yourself right now, maybe I do need help from other people. Maybe I haven't done too good on my own. So then it says, here are the steps that we took. And if that's not enough, if you don't like them kind of words, I'll give you another dandy to roll around tonight that'll surely screw up your sleep. Just as you lay your head down on that pillow tonight, and you're going to be the only one doing the business with you, so there's no sense in lying, unless you're into lying to yourself. Ask yourself this question. Am I right now what I would want my child to be? And then see if you can go to sleep. So then if you're ready to take these steps and admit that you're powerless over alcohol, because you didn't get here because you walked against the red light. You know, you didn't get here because you exceeded the speed limit. And you didn't get here because somebody's trying to get even with you. You got here because obviously you yourself are aware that alcohol has caused you to do things that perhaps you normally wouldn't do. And that's an example of lack of power, lack of power. And the fact that you're here shows that there's a degree of unmanageability in your life. Because this isn't where you're supposed to be. You've got a God-given right to live a life of your own and not to be dictated to by a jackass like me. It's your life. You run it, not me. So if you're aware of those things, then maybe you're aware of these steps. And these steps are a way to put decency and dignity back in your life. And in this little book, 12 by 12, it discusses all of the steps in depth. And it tells us here that who cares? The very first sentence says, who cares to admit complete defeat? And that's tough. Man, our egos are clash with that. Defeat. Surrender. God, those are ugly words. And yet they talk about them in AA constantly. You've lost the battle with alcohol. You got to give up. You got to surrender. Most of us, you know, with that little bit of macho attitude that we have deep inside of us someplace, you know, hate them words. You hate them words. I can only talk for myself, but I don't think I'm any different than any other person in here. In the world that I was raised in, you know, you didn't talk those words. You know, in the streets that I played on, or whatever the hell you want to call it, you know, you didn't talk about surrender. You didn't talk about giving up. And defeat, that was a word nobody ever even talked to, you know. Because defeat to me was a final thing. It meant you weren't as good as, that there was somebody beat you. And I don't come from that school, you know. I come from that, I always say that Vince Lombardi, the football coach school, you know. Vince was a tough son of a bitch, you know. And I always liked one thing he said, and it was always he made reference to a sign that you see in a lot of jackass high school coaches and college coaches' offices sometimes, you know. It says, it doesn't make any difference whether you win or lose. It's how you play the game. Bullshit. I never played a game in my life that I didn't want to win. And I never was in a game in my life that if I lost, I didn't feel bad about it. Whether I was playing for pennies or for $100 bills. Whether I was playing in a 1-9 season or for a state championship. I always wanted to win. Always wanted to win and never felt good when I lost. So it made a big difference to me whether I won or lose. And then you say you surrender. Let me tell you how I came about that. Some of you may have noticed during your stay here when you're not looking at the chicks or looking at the guys, that there's a picture over the fireplace out here of a horse. Okay, some of you have never seen a horse. That's a horse out there. It's a very, very famous horse. Recognized in thoroughbred circles, probably as the greatest thoroughbred racehorse that has ever lived as of today. Horse by the name of Man of War. Tremendous horse. Lost only one race in its entire career. Every race that it was in except one. He won. Big Red, they called him. Big Red. But even he got beat. And it's so ironic. Because the name of the horse that beat Man of War, beat him in New York State at Saratoga Springs, was a horse by the name of Upset. And the horse Upset never won another race after it beat Man of War. But it beat him, so he got beat. Here he was, recognized as champion of champions. Greatest there was. and then he got beat. But that wasn't final, because they pulled him right away off the circuit, put him out to pasture down there in Kentucky, rested him up a little bit, put a couple more pounds on him, looked at him to see what the hell was wrong, and fixed him. And then the following spring, they brought him back to Belmont and Aqueduct to start the race again, and on went his string, until eventually nobody would ever race against Man of War. In the latter stages of his career, he just ran against the clock. And then there was never even any pari mutuel betting when Man of War was in the race, because he was an odds-on favorite to win. And just before he retired, he only raced exhibitions. That's all. But he fathered some of the greatest racehorses that you and I know of our time. War Admiral, Seabiscuit, buried right up here in Willits. Great horses, great horses. Here was a horse that had got beat, but yet came back to still be recognized as champion of champions. Definite proof that just because you get beat doesn't mean you can't come back to be a winner. And that's exactly what you do here when you reach out and grab this thing called sobriety. You've lost. Accept that. You've been beat. But that's not final. There are a million men and women all over the world who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous that stand as living visual testimony that you can come back. And in most cases, and I say this with no hesitation, be a bigger winner than you ever were in life. Than you ever were in life. So the answer is here. The answer is here. If you want it. That's always the key. If you want it. And how wise those men and women were when they wrote this book. They said the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Now, sometimes that desire is hard to get. You know, when you're bouncing around, you're 23, 24 years old, and people are talking to you and making suggestions about giving up booze and drugs for the rest of your life, that's an earth-shattering suggestion. It certainly was to me. I remember thinking, holy Christ, 24 years old, that's all I was. What the hell are you talking about? That's like giving up my life. I can't do that. I'm just a young guy. Hell, I'm a big-time war hero. I'm supposed to be able to have fun now. And you're telling me no. Holy Jesus Christ. And so I fought that. But I wasn't unique there either. Because these guys who wrote this book and these women who shared in this book said the same thing 52 years ago. Quote, opening sentence, third chapter. Most of us were unwilling to admit that we were alcoholic, because no one likes to think that he or she is different. And you know, some years ago, God put a thought into my head. He had to do it because I don't have the brains to originate anything like this, especially something that makes as much sense as this. And that could possibly wipe out every excuse any of you in this room have right now. Because I know some of you don't want to be an alcoholic. Some of you don't want to be called addicts and shit like that. Because those are ugly words, right? Oh, there's an alcoholic. Did it ever dawn on you that you don't have to be an alcoholic to quit drinking? You don't have to be an addict to quit dope? As a matter of fact, all you got to do is apparently have a little common sense, a little dignity, and a little decency, and a little character in your life, and perhaps a little honesty to recognize that maybe, just maybe, this addiction, whatever the hell the drug is, alcohol or others, is not only affecting your life, but it's affecting the lives of other people. People who you presumably still care about and say you love. So if you're decent enough to recognize that, and you're not an addict, not an alcoholic, there should be no problem at all. You should say, well, hell, I just won't do that anymore. And then try. And then try. Now, if you can do that, you don't have to come to these goddamn meetings and buy these books and listen to all this bullshit. Hell no, you can go on your own merry way because you've got the power. But if you say you're going to do that and then you find out you can't do that and that you continue to drink and use, then perhaps, just perhaps, you need the support of other people. And maybe you need Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I believe most of you in this room tried to get sober, tried to clean up your act before you came here. Didn't you? Didn't you all say, well, hell, I don't want to spend that money. I'll stay home here and do it myself first. And here you are, loser. You lost. You lost. So come into this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And they tell us in this book that learn from your mistakes. Don't try to bury them. Don't try to hide them. You learn something from every drunk you go on. If you're lucky enough to live through it. Mistakes are the basis of knowledge. They're the basis of education. Do you know that way back there in the days of the caveman and all of that bullshit, that if one of them jackasses hadn't made a big mistake one day, we'd all be eating raw meat? You read the story as a child growing up about the guy that went out and slew whatever the hell they slew in them days, dinosaurs or whatever hell, and he was bringing the meat back into the cave for the clan to eat that winter, and as he came into the cave, he stumbled over the rocks and dropped the meat into the fire. And they killed him for that. But they were so hungry, they ate the meat and discovered it tasted better after it had been in the fire than raw. They learned from a mistake. Learned from a mistake. The first lesson that most of us learn as kids is don't put your finger into the fire. But we don't learn that until we put our finger into the fire. It's just like wet paint, right? Really? You gotta try it first. You gotta try it first, you know. I used to tell the FBI, I said, you make a big deal out of fingerprints, you know? Easiest way to do it is get a big billboard, put it out in the front. Just paint it. Say, wet paint, do not touch. You get everybody's fingerprint in Washington, D.C. that day, you know. In the 12 by 12 here, it says, first we were smitten by an insane urge that condemned us to go on. What does that mean? Well, I always talk about the dilemma. Dilemma is a scary word. I don't really know what the hell it means, but I know that it means something's going to happen. It just sounds bad. It's a kind of a word that should be in a Dracula movie, dilemma. You know. A dilemma is when you're confused and you need help in making a decision. And in the book, AA Comes of Age, it says this. Usually, a dilemma will precede our decision as to whether to continue on in our madness. I've never heard alcoholism or addiction described any better than madness. Or to reach out for recovery. The dilemma precedes that decision. I asked the guy once what the hell dilemma meant, because I couldn't understand it in the dictionary. He was a school teacher that belonged to our group. And I asked him one night in the parking lot outside after the meeting, I said, Paul, what the hell does dilemma mean? And I said, tell it to me in language that I'll understand. So he thought for a minute. And he said, well, dilemma, Duff, is when you have opposite answers for the same question, but both answers are valid. I figured he's going into early male menopause or something. You know? How the hell can you have opposite answers for the same question, you know? But I know now, and I know why they wrote it that way in the book. I was faced with a dilemma, and I'm quite sure many of you have been faced with this dilemma that preceded my decision. My dilemma came in a scumbag of a place called Big Rothschild's on West Madison Street in Chicago, Illinois. Real sleazebag of a place. But there's what my drinking had relegated me to. Skid Row Saloons. 6 o'clock in the morning. Most horrible hour of the day that the alcoholic has to face, you know. And you sort of shuffle in there, you know. And at that stage in your drinking career and your way of life, there's almost hardly any need for vocal communication anymore between you and the bartenders. Or maybe they don't know you personally, but they know you as a whole. They know what you are. And so you just gotta shuffle in there. And you grovel around in your pockets, you know, and come up with whatever the hell adds up to 15 cents. Pennies and nickels and Canadian coins, and sometimes you try to pass a bus token or whatever. And you just scatter it out there on the bar, and almost in silent prayer, you pray to God that he takes it. And if he takes it, then in exchange, he pours 4 ounces of wine into a 7-ounce paper cup. It certainly isn't the wine that comes out of the Napa Valley. Something more like the pride of Lodi or something like that. That if you don't drink it, you can use it to take rust off of bolts or something like that. And don't laugh at me. Some of you have been there, right? You look at that goddamn friggin' drink, and you know it's killing you. You know that. You know it's tearing your life apart. You know it's taking your family from me. You know it smashed all of the dignity and decency you've ever had in you. You know that. But yet you're shaking and every nerve and every muscle in your body is twitching and hollering and screaming. And you look there at that goddamn paper cup and you know friggin' well that if I don't drink it, I'm gonna die. If I don't drink this, I'm gonna die. I have to have it. But then in the back of your head, something else is saying, but if you don't drink it, Duff, it'll kill you. If I drink it, I'll die, and if I don't drink it, it'll kill me. I need to drink to live so I can drink to die. And that's a confusing state of mind. And that's called dilemma. If I drink it, it'll kill me, and if I don't drink it, I'll die. Opposite answers for the same question, and they're both valid. And so it's at that time that we're trying to make this decision in a confused state of mind. And nobody can make a good decision when they're confused. So you have the choice. Should I continue on in this madness, or should I reach out and ask for help? Please help me. God, help me. Will you help me? Someone help me. That's how simple it is to get a life that's so abundant that if you were given an opportunity to write out the script for your future right now, you'd shortchange yourself. Because you don't even believe that it's possible for you to stop drinking, let alone to reap the benefits that come with this new way of life. I don't know if it was here or someplace else recently where I said that. I said, when I came to AA, if they had said, what do you want in sobriety? You know what I would have said? All I want is a new pickup truck, a mortar mixer, and a laborer to help me work. Thought I would have wanted. And look what I got. Look what I got. And I'm not different. I'm not different. So I surrendered. And the book told me that I had to do that. It told me that in the third chapter of this book. And it told me why that was so important and why it's so important to you today. It says, we conceded. We surrendered. We conceded to our innermost self. To me, not my wife, not my boss, not my friends, not the counselor, me. That's who's the problem, you. And that's who you got to do business with, nobody else. So we conceded to our innermost self, what? That we were alcoholic. Alcoholic as defined how? As defined in that book. Where it says, men and women who have lost the ability to control their drinking. I had to admit that. I have lost the ability to control my drinking. That's tough to do. But it tells me that if I do that, that's the beginning of my recovery. It says that's the first step towards recovery. I'm on my way. I'm on my way. I've got rid of the problem, now I'm working on the solution. And if you're working on the solution, you can't have a problem. And things began to get better and better and better. And in that second step, they told me that I had to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. There have been many powers greater than me and you. Jim Beam, Jack Daniels, Anheuser-Busch, Ernest and Julio. Lots of powers greater than me. And if you don't believe that, think quickly of how many things in your life, as I said the other day, that you wish hadn't happened. And yet they did. Why do people like you and I constantly say, I wouldn't have done that if I hadn't been drinking. I wouldn't have said that if I hadn't been drinking. That meant that I had undoubtedly gone into a part of my life that I had no control over. And sanity is a scary word, huh? It sounds like mental institutions. Restore me to sanity. If I admit that, then I'm admitting that I must have been temporarily insane. And I don't like that. But wait a minute. You haven't been admitting that you've been looking for insanity ever since you started to drink. Ever since you started to put needles in your arms or shit up your nose. Because you know what you say when people say, why do you drink? Why do you drug? I want to escape from reality. What is the definition of the opposite of reality? Insanity. I drink and I drug because I want to go insane. I want to be out of control. That's exactly what you're doing. You want to turn over the reins to somebody else to pull you on the little white sled through the rose garden and over the clouds and through the sun, you know. But it don't always come out that way, does it? Sometimes they find you in the top standing on the railing in the middle of the Golden Gate Bridge. What the fuck kind of trip is this, you know? Powerless over alcohol. Then perhaps you're not an alcoholic after all. But you know what my answer was to that. You don't have to be an alcoholic to quit drinking. But then some of us are going to try to drink again, even after we get sober. And I guess that's why they say in the book, especially people who read these jackass articles that have been coming out in the paper lately, but it says in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, quote, physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree that there is no such a thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. It's a science may one day accomplish this, but it has not done so yet. Normal drinker. I said it last night, you know, and I don't like to say things like that, but, you know, you didn't pay me to lie to you. Some of us, quite possibly in this room, are going to die as a result of drinking and using. And it says it in the book why we'll do that. It says that we're going to persist in an illusion. Somehow, some way, you know, we'll once more be able to drink like normal people. That's the hidden obsession, it says in the book, of every abnormal drinker. That somehow, some way, someday, he'll once more be able to control and enjoy his drinking. Be a social drinker. How insane that is. I've been working with alcoholics for, you know, close to 35 years. I never saw an alcoholic, male or female, who walked the face of this earth who could ever adhere to the conditions that surround social drinking for more than 5 seconds. Or have you forgotten how normal drinkers drink? Watch a normal drinker sometime. They'll drive you to drink. They'll drive you crazy watching them. They leave half of a drink on the bar and go home. And they say the goddamnedest things. No thanks. I've had enough. Two's it for me. I'm driving. They put caps back on bottles. They say, let's eat. It's sort of nice that we can laugh at ourselves. But you know, there's tragedy behind that laughter. And I certainly am not trying to put the hex on people. I'm just telling you how it is. Somebody in this room is going to die trying to be like a normal drinker. When that's the last thing you want to be. Would you really be satisfied when somebody said, let's go in and have a drink, and that's all you do? Just have a drink? You know what have a drink meant to me and you? Have a drink means that there are 6 of you in a carpool. And on the way home, somebody says, let's go in and have a drink. That means each guy buys a round of drinks. That we have 6 drinks, not a drink, you know. Did you ever get caught in a spot where you get surrounded by people who aren't drinking? objectives. Then you have to do them clever little things that we do, and they get embarrassing at times. Unless a mystery drops into them all of a sudden. I'm not talking about a time like that. And it might have been the beginning of my awareness of my own problem with drinking. Because I realized that night that not only I, but other people were doing things that normal people don't do. My first wife's family was, Christ, they were so goddamn dry they were a fire hazard, you know? Really. No drinking at all. And on occasions, you know, you have to go play that family bullshit, you know. Coming over to Carolyn's for a shower or some shit like that. And I'd go, and I'd have a Mickey in the glove compartment of the car, and one in my sock. And then I'd get there early. They always prided me on being one of the first to arrive. But that's because I had to get into the bathroom and take the top off of the water closet, you know, and put my bottle down into the water closet. And every now and then during the evening, I could shoot in there, you know, and make believe go in the bathroom and then take a whack out of that jug. And that's how I used to do it. And I used to hate to have to do that until sometimes it gets entertaining. Because one night we were all gathered there, all these dry asses, you know. I had gone back in, popped it about three times. And when I went in for the fourth trip, I took all the crap off the top of the water closet, lifted up the closet, and God damn it, there was another half pint in there. And I spent the rest of the night trying to figure out who the hell that was. One of my brother-in-laws thought I was getting queer for bathrooms because I sat right by the bathroom door watching everybody go in, you know. He thought I was sort of freaking out, you know. And I never did find out who the hell that was, you know. I sort of think it might have been my wife. Now I believe that because she sort of turned into a lush too later on. But there they are. There's the directions, you know, 1, 2, and 3. They're no big deal. They're no big deal. If you don't think you need to be restored to sanity, think of the insane things you've done. And insane isn't a crazy word, it's a legal word. Insane is a legal word that defines mental illness. Mental illness. And the definition of the word insane or insanity is this. Any time you place your life or the life of others in jeopardy as a result of your actions, that's insanity. And every one of you who identified yourself as an addict or an alcoholic has done that already. You have placed your life in jeopardy. But don't think you're mentally ill to a point where you have to be carted off in a straitjacket. There are thousands and thousands and perhaps millions of people right now, normal, apparently normal people who are doing insane things. When you walk against a red light, you are placing your life in jeopardy. That is an insane act. If the sign says slow to 35 and you do 36, you are placing your life and the lives of others in jeopardy. That, too, is an insane act. For an addict or an alcoholic to think that he or she can return to normal drinking, or as the book says, persist in that illusion, is an insane act. Proven over and over and over again, but pointed out very clearly in the foreword to the first edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, where it clearly says, many of us participated in countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like other people. The illusion that somehow, some way, we can once more enjoy our drinking has to be smashed. You have to accept that. If you don't, you die. if you're an alcoholic. And you die the way alcoholics die. Alcoholics die on a field of battle. But not with a flag unfurled and the bands and the cheers of countless thousands. You die groveling. You die choking and gasping and unwanted and unnoticed. And in most cases, not even mourned. That's how you die. Any questions or any comments before I close this meeting? Yes.